First case is Lally v. Country Mutual Insurance Company. Council President Reddy?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, very good. We'll take that case first. Second case is Reynolds v. Allstate, same counsel?
Same here, Your Honor.
Different counsel? All right, very good. We'll take that case second. I'm sure most of you have argued here before. For those who have not, let me simply review the ground rules. These cases are set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system at the podium, which works as follows. When your time commences, the green light goes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light comes on. And when your full 15 minutes have expired, the red light comes on. You'll know how much time you have left because there's a clock on the podium which counts backwards from 15. That tells you how much time you have left. We would ask you to stay close to the podium, please, because we're recording your arguments today. We sometimes find it beneficial to go back and listen to them again. And if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well. Also be advised that the arguments are available over the internet within a week or so following today's argument. So if there's anything of a confidential nature, be guided by that warning. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument, that's fine with us. However, the case is yours to argue as you wish. Finally, if anyone has a cell phone or a pager, please ensure it's turned off at this time. We're ready for argument.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Hill, and I represent the plaintiff's appellants. With me at council table is Tom McFarland. I'm going to make a very brief statement and then proceed to the argument. This is, and always has been, a non-disclosure case. Our complaint in this case set forth five different claims, each with different elements, but all premised upon the very same underlying allegation that Country Mutual failed to meet its legal duty to, as set forth in this court's 1997 opinion in Jones versus USA, and I'll quote, to disclose fully and fairly to insureds what insurance protection is actually being provided for the premium charge, close quote. As your honors know, this court has already addressed 10 companion appeals and reversed the trial court in each of those 10. It seemed to me maybe at that milestone it might make sense in the argument to kind of go back to a couple of very basic elements. Plaintiffs in this case allege two non-disclosures. First, we allege that Country Mutual should have disclosed that the purchase of UIM coverage on one vehicle provided the policyholder and all resident relatives with UIM coverage on all vehicles. We allege that should have been disclosed to each and every purchaser of UIM coverage. Second, we alleged that the Country Mutual should have disclosed what, if any, additional UIM coverage they were, the insureds were receiving in return for paying the additional premiums for multiple vehicles. It's undisputed in the record in this case that Country Mutual failed to make either of those disclosures, and the question on appeal is whether the court properly dismissed this on a summary judgment motion after declining to grant a continuance to permit plaintiffs to conduct discovery.
Counsel, is there evidence in the record that the Lallys actually purchased coverage from Country Mutual?
Yes.
Where is that?
Your Honor, can I ask one of my colleagues to look at that record site, because I don't have it in front of me immediately, but I'll try to get it to you during the argument.
Fair enough.
There's a lot of verbiage in the 10 cases and in the oral arguments that lead up to those 10 cases, as well as the two cases here this afternoon. If we step back for a minute, though, if you look at the trial court's ruling, the trial court divided the insurance world into two sections, two basic categories. Those plaintiffs' claims that were against insurers who had issued single vehicle policies were allowed to proceed to class certification, and those that were against insurers who employed a multi-vehicle policy, in other words, covering multi-vehicles under a single policy, were all summarily dismissed. As the court said in Hartford, the trial court determined that all insurers do not necessarily have the same disclosure obligations. And as this court noted in Amica, the trial court held that insurers who employed a multi-vehicle policy did not have a duty to disclose the effect of DHERERA, And the converse was, those who did use a single policy, excuse me, multiple single policies, did have that duty. In short, we can put all the complicated language aside, and we simply have one test, whether the defendant employed a multi-vehicle policy. The existence or non-existence of an owned but not insured exclusion made no difference whatsoever. The trial court summarily dismissed approximately a dozen cases in which the insurer had kept an OBNI exclusion in the policy after deherrera, and dismissed at least three cases in which one was not in there at any time during the class period. Similarly, the fact that the insurer did or did not make other misleading statements, such as the use of an inaccurate, misleading summary disclosure form, made no difference whatsoever. It all came down to the policy. Now, at this point, after 10 cases, it's probably understandable, each of the appellants now is seeking to distinguish themselves from the prior 10 cases. They're ignoring what they said before the trial court, they're ignoring the arguments they presented to the trial court, and trying to find some factual nuance that they can suggest to this court should justify a different outcome than in the other 10 cases. However, if we go back to the trial court, there was only one thing that made a difference: whether the insurance company employed a multi-vehicle policy as a business practice. That was the sole determining factor. The 10 opinions to date do make a couple of things very, very clear. First, this court, and by now it's 13 separate judges, each and every one of whom have voted for reversal. Each and every one of those judges found at least two common themes to reverse. First, by ignoring the multiple bases, other than 10-4-609, that plaintiffs allege to establish the insurer's duty to disclose information, or by defining the duty under all the multiple other obligations, the other four statutory obligations as well as the common law obligations, establishing a duty, that the trial court improperly applied the law regarding the duty under those statutes. Second, the trial court improperly invaded the province of the jury in determining as a matter of law whether the information that the insurers admittedly failed to disclose was material.
Mr. Hill, let me stop you there. What evidence in this record is there that your clients in this case relied to any extent upon statements made or not made by the carrier?
Your Honor, there is very little evidence in this record because, for one thing, as you know, we sought a 56F extension and were denied that because the court said there was no need for any evidence other than what was in the policy. So that would be my first response.
But you haven't appealed that issue, have you? The failure to grant you additional...
We have simply pointed it out in the appeal that the court should not have granted summary judgment without giving us a chance to conduct discovery. But, Your Honor, if you step past that, as the court recently held in Hartford in a companion case, plaintiffs are not required to prove they would have made a different decision. Plaintiffs are not required to prove that they relied on a non-disclosure, and this is a non-disclosure case. And the reason for that, under a line of cases starting with Affiliated Ute in the United States Supreme Court many years ago, is the courts have uniformly held that it's sort of impossible for a plaintiff to say, what would we have done if something had been disclosed to us that was material but was not disclosed to us? Because that essentially calls for speculation.
So is it all right to simply respond to a motion for summary judgment that has affidavits attached by simply making arguments of counsel in a non-disclosure case?
Well, if it goes to that issue of reliance, the answer would be yes. Now, the truth is, Your Honor, we did not do that. We put in a number of things that we alleged, if allowed first to pursue discovery, and then based upon the record, would, in our view, cause this to be misleading. But our basic theory of it was, Your Honor, that without any additional facts, simply selling insurance in the state of Colorado post-deherrera required the first disclosure. And that disclosure was to tell people that if you purchased this policy, it was going to, after deherrera, follow the people, not the vehicle.
But I haven't seen any evidence in the record that I hate to keep harping on this, but that the insurers sold insurance to your client. We don't have the insurance policy or the declaration, for example, which I assume you wouldn't need discovery to get. We don't have bills showing that they paid on a multiple vehicle basis. How do we know that this is a multi-vehicle policy?
Your Honor, there are always a few embarrassing moments in court when we've gone through this entire case, the trial court and the Court of Appeals, and assume, because it was true, that that was in the record. And if that is not in the record, I'm going to be grossly embarrassed, because both sides have made that assumption throughout. It's never been an issue that's been raised before. I will try to come back to it and look at some papers on the on my break and come back, and if I can find something in the record in that time, I will respond. But the assumption has been throughout, and I believe it to be factually true. If there's nothing in the record, that is an oversight that has been ignored by both sides. Yeah, going back to the second question, which we say there should have been a disclosure, which was if they were going to charge additional premium over and above the single vehicle premium, they should have disclosed what, if anything, the insured was getting as a result of making that payment. And that, again, was not done here. And, Your Honor, that's important not just for the purpose of our case, but, for example, when De Herrera changed the policies to follow the people rather than the vehicles, as had been the case in the past, that meant if people were informed of that, how would people know to file claims even? But more importantly in this case, it is how would people know to make an informed decision, which was exactly the point the case the court made in Hartford in the recent published opinion, which is to say only with that information could people make informed decisions about what insurance they wanted to buy and how they wanted to go about buying it. The challenge for Country Mutual here is to suggest suddenly at this late stage that the trial court's decision here was based solely on the absence of an owned but not insured exclusion. That's not been consistent with any ruling of the trial court, and it's not been consistent with the rulings of this court. Judge Bernard's decision in Amica also presented a situation where it was unquestioned that there was no OBNI in the policy during the class period, and that case was reversed just as with the other nine cases.
Actually, counsel, to be completely accurate, there was an OBNI, but it had been removed with an endorsement.
Yes, and that's, if I can just repeat, I was trying to be careful about that. It was removed prior to the class period,
that's
why I say during the class period, there was no OBNI in the claim, so we did not claim that. Now, in that case, I think we argued on the common law duty that there were two common law duties, one of which is the normal common law duty to disclose that which should be material and disclosed. The second is if you created a misimpression by a prior statement, you should come back and correct that. We're not arguing that second point here. If I'm reading this correctly, I have about 4 minutes and I'd reserve that time.
Very well.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Lisa Lilly. I represent Country Mutual along with Terrence Ridley. Your Honors, this case is unlike any of the other UM-UIM cases that divisions of this court heard that Mr. Hill brought based on De Herrera. That is because Country Mutual, unlike those other insurers, always offered UM-UIM coverage that followed the person, not the vehicle. Country Mutual never had an owned but not insured exclusion in its policies, not before De Herrera, not when De Herrera was decided, and not now. In fact, that's the basis on which Country Mutual moved to sever the Lally case from the other Young cases in 2005. A month later, we produced all our policy documents with initial disclosures, so plaintiffs have those. That is also the basis on which Country Mutual move for summary judgment, and it is the sole basis. I'll take Mr. Hill's challenge. It is the sole basis on which the trial court granted summary judgment. The court's order on page 4 notes that although the plaintiffs had raised all these arguments about all or nothing policies and multi-vehicle policies, the court says Country Mutual does not discuss multi-vehicle policies and single UM-UIM elections in its brief. Instead, it simply states there never were owned but not insured exclusions for UM-UIM coverage in any of its Colorado policies. Then at the end of the order, the court notes that plaintiffs failed to establish any fact contradicting that, and therefore the court finds there are no genuine issues a material fact for trial.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Lilly, but to go to Judge Miller's form, prior counsel, do we have the policy here? Do we know that there was an insurance contract? Does the record tell us what the terms of that policy were?
The record actually does not include the plaintiff's declaration pages or the policies. At the point we moved for summary judgment, up to that point, plaintiffs had argued, and the trial court agreed in the order on a motion for determination at law, that insurers who had an owned but not insured exclusion had misinformed their insureds about whether coverage was available per person or per vehicle, and said that if you had that OBNI, your duty then was to correct the non-disclosure or the misinformation. Based on that, we moved for summary judgment and said, we never had an OBNI in our policies. In response, plaintiffs continued to rely on the OBNI. They did not come back, as they did in the Amica case, with their policy and say, look, here's the owned but not insured exclusion, and as Mr. Hill argued in that case, you've got to wade through 20, 30 pages of endorsements to see that it was removed after D. Herrera. That's not the case here. They didn't come back and say that. They did not come back with their declaration pages, as they did in some of the other cases, and say, here's some language on here that was misleading. And they didn't come back with an affidavit, which was certainly within their knowledge to do, saying, here's what's deceptive about something Country Mutual said to us, some document we saw, some statement that was made. Instead, what plaintiffs did, as they had done before, was rely on the OBNI. In fact, they incorporated into their opposition to summary judgment a motion to reconsider from the Maxwell versus USAA case, and they said that for the same reasons that they were asking the court to reconsider Maxwell, they were opposing summary judgment. Well, when we go to the Maxwell brief, it's all about how the owned but not insured exclusion misinformed insureds and how the trial court was incorrect in finding that insurers with multi-vehicle policies had no duty to correct that misinformation. In fact, plaintiffs go so far in that brief as to concede that the only effect, and that's on page 17 of Exhibit 1 to their opposition to summary judgment, that the only impact of D. Herrera for Class 1 insureds such as themselves is that unbeknownst to them, the owned but not insured exclusion was invalid. So that was clearly the basis for the non-disclosure claims, and plaintiffs have not provided any other basis on which to rest those claims. They have not refuted Country Mutual's showing that we don't have that exclusion, that we never had that exclusion, and they haven't provided any other basis on which to rest their claims.
Just to follow up on that, I think in their complaint they allege that there is a premium charge for additional vehicles, and at least in this court they have made that argument as well, and that the failure to disclose that such coverage is not necessary makes it misleading. So I'm not sure, do they have a burden? Is it their burden to come forward? They've made the allegation. When you move for summary judgment, I recall the Country Mutual said, oh no, we don't have, I don't think they've ever said, we don't have additional premiums for additional vehicles. So isn't the burden at this point on Country Mutual to come forward showing that they do not have extra premiums for additional vehicles?
Your Honor, if plaintiffs had showed how that tied to their non-disclosure claims and they had produced anything saying that they saw additional premiums and this was deceptive, then we would have had to come back with some evidence responding to that. What all plaintiffs did was they did make arguments, as they did in the other cases. They didn't support it with anything in the record, and they didn't explain how, in the absence of an owned but not insured exclusion and a policy that misinformed the insureds, how that could be deceptive or misleading. In the other cases that Your Honor referenced that were before divisions of this court, the courts found that in some cases the additional premium could be misleading because there was an owned but not insured exclusion. So the insureds might think that because the policy told them you don't have coverage unless you're in an insured vehicle, and they look at their deck pages and they see an extra charge, that could be deceptive or misleading. The courts also found that might contradict the defendant's arguments in those cases that they offered coverage on a per-policy basis. In other words, the defendants there argued, as Your Honors know, that there was no reason for them to correct their nondisclosure or their misinformation because they didn't offer their insureds an option to purchase coverage per vehicle. So they said it really couldn't make a difference to their insureds if they misunderstood the coverage because they couldn't buy the coverage any different way. So in that context, it clearly is a material fact whether you really offered the coverage on a per policy basis. And if that declaration page suggests otherwise, then that's something that would be a question of fact. Here, that's not the issue that was raised, and it's not a question of single policy or offering per vehicle or per driver. Country Mutual always offered their coverage per driver. So however they charge for the premiums or calculated the premiums really goes only to the amount the insureds paid, not to what was shown to the insureds. The plaintiffs haven't brought in anything saying that the Lallys saw a declaration page that confused them, that they saw something about our rates that confused them, or that was misleading. In short, Your Honors, the plaintiffs simply haven't shown any other basis for their non-disclosure claims. Country Mutual handled coverage in a way that was correct. We got it right. Even before De Herrera, we were offering coverage on a per-person basis. We were doing exactly what the De Herrera and Hines courts said that we should be doing. Plaintiffs have not refuted that showing. Throughout their time in the trial court, they continued to rely for their non-disclosure claims on the OBNI that we never had, and for that reason, summary judgment should be upheld.
Ms. Neely, let me ask you a question, if I may. Is there evidence in this record that that the Lallys owned two vehicles that they insured with Country Mutual?
No, Your Honor, there isn't anything in the record on that.
How do we, so are we dealing with one vehicle only, and we have no question about a two-tiered premium structure like we might have with the Allstate case, which is being argued next?
Your Honor, it's a long time since I looked at those initial disclosures, so I wouldn't want to speculate on how many vehicles there were, but there is not anything in the record on that. Certainly plaintiffs have alleged that.
So what do we have then? We have one premium charged and no breakdown as to what that covers or why it is being charged.
You know, the only thing in the record, plaintiffs attached to their opposition to summary judgment, a document showing base rates for various country entities and three different types of vehicles. So it shows a base rate of $22 for private passenger autos. There's nothing else in the record. There's nothing in the record showing how coverage was charged for additional vehicles. It just shows base rates, okay. Which is why Country Mutual argued in its reply that the only thing left to plaintiffs was a rating, a pricing question, which would be barred by the filed rate doctrine. But there is nothing, no deck page in the record. Thank you.
Excuse me. If I understand you, the basis for your motion for summary judgment in the trial court was solely that there was no, that Country Mutual has never had during the relevant time period an OBNI clause. Is that correct?
Right. It was that we had never had that exclusion. So basically, De Herrera didn't change the coverage we offered. We offered the same coverage that we always had. Therefore, under the court's order on the determination of law, which has not been appealed and which plaintiffs didn't challenge, there was no corrective disclosure to make because there was no misinformation provided. Plaintiffs have argued that the trial court divided these cases into the multi-vehicle policies, one policy, multiple vehicles, and the single policy, single vehicles, and that was the only distinction. But in fact, for the country case, the trial court specifically looked at the owned but not insured exclusion and looked at that prior determination of law, finding that it was only if you had an OBNI that you had this duty to correct any misinformation provided.
So is it your position that if the omission claim fails, all the rest of the claims fall with it?
Yes, Your Honor, because all, I think Mr. Hill's been very clear, all his claims are non-disclosure claims. They're all based on this idea that we offered coverage incorrectly, that we informed our insureds that they had to buy coverage on a per-vehicle basis.
So on what grounds can we say that the trial court specifically disposed of those other claims? It didn't really address those, did it?
Well, I think the court found that because the only duty was if you made an incorrect disclosure by having an OB&I, you had to fix that. The court was saying that applied to all of the claims.
So as a matter of law, there's no bad faith. As a matter of law, there's no deceptive trade practice. But it didn't say that. Can we say that?
I believe you can, Your Honor. This court can affirm on any basis that's supported in the record. And further, the factual basis for all of Mr. Hill's claims, all throughout the trial court, as I said, even when opposing our summary judgment, was that the OB&I was deceptive, created this misinformation, this failure to disclose, and bad faith. That was the basis for all his claims.
My recollection is the complaint also alleges that it's misleading to charge a premium for a second vehicle when the coverage follows the person already, and to not disclose that the coverage is not necessary. Now, I know you may not agree with that as a factual matter, but I think that was their claim that's pretty clearly stated in their complaint. And I don't think it matters for that claim whether or not there's an OB&I clause, does it?
I think it does, because what they were saying is, before De Herrera, their assumption in the complaint, their allegation, was that all the insurance companies, because they sued all of them at once, were offering coverage on a per-vehicle basis. So that once De Herrera happened, now we know coverage has to be offered per person. So if you were charging additional premiums, your insureds, because of that misinformation, wouldn't understand what they were getting. Because I don't think Mr. Hill has ever said that there's no value, or maybe he has, that there's no value to that additional coverage that you would get for what's been called Class 2 insureds, but just that insured should be informed what they're getting. They should know what they're getting. And the fact that we didn't have an OB&I, our insureds always knew what they were getting. So they knew what they were getting, they knew what their premiums were, and they could make a decision what they wanted to purchase.
There may be this Class 1, Class 2 distinction in your policy, but the policy's not before us, and I don't think the complaint refers to that difference. So I think the complaint is maybe arguing that there's no value at all to that second vehicle that you're charging for, the second premium you're charging for the second vehicle.
Well, I would say to that, at any rate, then that's what Mr. Hill should have been, that's how he should have been responding to summary judgment, and he should have provided some evidence on that. He had a burden to come forth and refute our showing, and opted not to do that, opted not to put anything in the record, not the deck pages, not anything showing the premiums. You know, he chose to simply basically lift arguments from another brief, arguments that we had never made. And I see that my time is up, so thank you, Your Honor.
I'll try to address a couple of the specific questions just quickly. I think there's a semantic difference going on here, particularly in the question of these duties and what triggers the duties. We're not alleging that the duty gets triggered by the presence of an OB&I. Now, true, in other instances, in other cases, what we are saying is that the first duty, the duty to disclose to whom it applies when you buy UM/UIM, covers every single purchaser. Every single purchase, a single vehicle, just like a dual vehicle or multi-vehicle. That's triggered simply by the sale of insurance, if you look at any of the statutes. It doesn't have anything, none of the statutes have anything to do with OB&I. If somebody also had an OB&I and kept an OB&I, that's an additional indicia, it seems to me, of the evidentiary need to have a disclosure. It's not what establishes the duty. And in terms of the second duty that we've alleged, what, if anything, you're getting for that, is just triggered simply by charging something different. And to one of your questions here, we did attach in our opposition brief at page 3 to the trial court a rate filing from the Division of Insurance, which quote says, evidencing the additional UM/UIM premiums charged to multi-vehicle policies, close quote. That's Country Mutual filing with the Division of Insurance. So there is no question, and it's never been disputed in this case, that they do have an additional charge. And what we're saying is, if you have an additional multi-vehicle charge, then that triggers the second duty, which is the duty to disclose what, if anything, the person's getting. Some of this is, again, semantics on the second level. There is a suggestion that in some of these instances, depending on how one interprets the policy language, and we don't need to do that today, that certain Class II insureds get additional coverage. What we have consistently alleged is that the insured and all the resident insureds get no additional coverage, and there's no dispute about that. In some instances, the policy says the Class II insureds get. In others, it says it's ambiguous. So I've never relied upon that. I've never argued that. It's simply if, as here, the rate filings indicate that you're going to pay something additional for that, we think you should be told what, if anything, you're getting. In trying to quickly look to answer your Honor's questions about the record, from what I can see quickly and from what I have here with me today, I think we alleged that in the complaint there were multi-vehicles. We alleged it. I don't think it was ever disputed or argued. If you look at their statement of undisputed facts, they simply say that these two individuals are insured, and they cite to the complaint at paragraph 20, and that their policy included UM coverage, and I realize, and they cite to three different paragraphs. And I think there is perhaps an absence, and the only defense I can make is that we did file a Rule 56F motion when this thing was filed. We asked for a variety of insurance relating to the premiums and different information about them, and they argued that they were relevant because you could simply look at the policies to determine that it was a multi-policy, essentially, situation. The district court agreed and denied our effort for discovery. So the only thing we...
Is the policy in the record, Mr. Hill?
Excuse me?
Is the policy in the record?
There is a blank policy and some deck pages. I can't find the policy.
Thank you.
Okay. If you're talking about our client's policy, which I assume you were. So I think we're here in the nomenclature. This court never ruled on any of the alternative grounds for a basis. And each of those bases was triggered simply by the sale of insurance that would apply to anybody selling insurance in Colorado. And then the second would have applied to anybody selling insurance who was charging something additional. And if we go back to Jones, the mandate from this court universally has been under all of those standards. Putting aside the Parfrey decision, we'll just leave that aside. Let's talk about the other four statutory bases and the other common law bases has been people are entitled to know what they're paying for and what they're getting for what they're paying. And that's been the simple thesis of our entire case. I see my time's up.
Thank you for your arguments in this case. We will issue a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can be prepared on the Reynolds versus Allstate case, we'll hear that.